gets colder. My eyes go thin as I get older. Piece in pieces, bloody and bruised. I feel so helpless and confused. Cause I hear screaming on the left, yelling on the right. I'm sitting in the middle trying to live my
Good afternoon. This is Evelyn Pringle. Welcome to Focus on the Facts. My guest today will be Dr. Amy Reed's husband, Dr. Hooman Norsrim, who is leading the campaign to ban power morcellation with devices used in hysterectomies to remove fibroids in the uterus. Their campaign to ban morcellation began in 2013 after Amy's unsuspected uterine cancer was spread through her abdomen by morcellation through a routine hysterectomy in October 2013 at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Hooman was a cardiac surgeon at Brigham at the time, and he started an online petition and sent out dozens of letters to the media and medical journals charging that morcellation for hysterectomies was creating a public health crisis. Hooman told me in an email that him and Amy hope they can cure this cancer, but they both see the responsibility to a greater cause than their own. At the core of our public health campaign, he said, is the idea that the lives, rights, and dignity of minority sets of unsuspecting people, however these groups might be defined, cannot be sacrificed for the sake of majority benefit, for convenience, for choice, or for economic advantage. Our story is not and will not be a tragedy, he said. It is a story of hope, love, optimism, and redemption in a world that could at times seem utterly mad and mixed up. And I know that Amy will have the story of one heck of a fight to tell our grandchildren, he said. For over two decades, this procedure has been killing thousands of women every year in the U.S. and more around the world. An FDA study revealed that 1 in 350 women who have hysterectomies for fibroid removal actually have sarcoma, which means that every day 2 to 5 women had deadly cancer spread because of morcellation. And yet not a single gynecologist, hospital, or advice maker had ever reported this adverse reaction to the FDA, which is required by law. Amy and Hooman were the first to report this to the FDA after Amy became a victim in 2013. They also learned that Brigham's administration and their Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology had a clear understanding of the hazard of morcellation by 2011, and Brigham had a previous fatality from this procedure. In their campaign against morcellation, they challenged the FDA, Congress, the gynecological profession, hospitals, and the medical device makers. To date, the FDA has issued a black box warning against the procedure, and many insurance companies are refusing to pay for morcellation. Hospitals have reduced or stopped using the procedure, and the Government Accountability Office and the FBI have launched investigations on the FDA, on hospitals across the U.S., and device makers, basically to see how long they've known this was going on and did nothing about it. As an investigative journalist for more than a dozen years, I've covered many of these kinds of campaigns against bad drugs or devices approved by the FDA. And when people like Amy and Hooman go up against Big Pharma, they also have to fight against all the other players that Big Pharma has in their pocket, which includes the FDA, gynecologists, and the hospitals making money off the device, and their pharma-funded front groups. I've been investigating this morcellation issue for about 3 months, and I've never seen such cold and heartless behavior before by all the players in bullying Amy and Hooman over the past few years. This couple has 6 young children, and Amy has been getting treatment for her cancer, but they continue to carry out this campaign to ban morcellation to save the lives of all the other women who may be subjected to this procedure if it remains on the market. Last year, they received the National Center for Health Research's Public Policies Award for Health Policy Heroes for saving lives and improving medical care. I want to welcome Hooman to the show right now and discuss these issues further. Hooman, are you there?
I am. Hello, Evelyn. How are you?
Welcome. Good. I'm real good. Glad to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm sorry, Amy was unable to join us today.
Okay. Well, I'm just glad that you could come on. I'm real anxious to hear where you're at in this campaign. I think I listed off all the different things that you accomplished as we were on a couple weeks ago and we talked about that. Has anything further come of your campaign?
We're basically waiting for the main thing that's going on right now is we're waiting for the Government Accountability Office to generate its report on this issue for Congress. And, I think there's several congressmen. Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania had rallied about 12 congressmen in a bipartisan fashion to call for this GAO investigation. And I think once the result of that comes out, we'll be able to sink our teeth into it more and hopefully stimulate broader congressional action. There's also requests out to the Office of Criminal Investigation at the FDA itself, as well as the FBI, which you mentioned in your introductory remarks, which seemingly has initiated an investigation. So,
great. You know, I find it hard to believe that this has been going on for over 20 years and the FDA had no inkling that this was happening. I mean, I don't even care if the hospitals or device makers or anything else didn't notify them. I just can't believe that they did not have any inkling that this was happening.
Well, you know, the trouble is with the entire medical device regulatory framework, Evelyn, it's not, you know, it's not terribly surprising, actually, given how the regulatory framework is set up. Now, you know, there are a lot of troubles on the drug side of the equation as well at the FDA, but certainly, you know, the drug side is probably about two decades ahead of where the device regulatory framework is. And when I say that, I mean that the device medical device regulatory framework, for the most part, is not really a safety-based framework. The dominant mechanism for approving medical devices in our country is called the 510K mechanism, and this really is not a, you know, it's really a regulatory framework designed to get life-saving devices onto the market fast. It's not really geared towards ensuring patient safety. And in addition to that, you know, there are really no adequate windows of post-market surveillance enforced. So, you know, it's not like the FDA is demanding that most device manufacturers survey their outcomes. And very certainly the FDA has not had a very good track record or habit of demanding and prosecuting failures to self-report outcomes. So, you know, the truth about the power morcellator is that the first time the FDA in 20 years has heard about this problem with power morcellators is when I filed the report sometime in November of 2013. And that's been confirmed by them. So for 20 years, this device has been used worldwide, harming women at a rate of somewhere in the 1 in 300 to 1 in 500. And these women's cancers have been upstaged. Many had been had developed advanced stage sarcomatosis. And you know, this was unknown to the FDA because no one had reported it to them. So, you know, the problem is the regulatory framework governing medical devices in the United States.
You know, I was going to ask you, I doubt that many of my listeners really know about how a medical device gets approved in this country. Could you explain that a little more thoroughly, you know, how easy it is to get approved? And then we were talking about how they don't follow up on how the device is actually working. But
sure.
How a device gets approved in this?
Sure. There are two pathways for medical devices to get approved. And the dominant pathway is called the 510K pathway. And that's basically the vast majority of medical devices in this country go through that pathway. The second pathway is the PMA, or the pre-market approval pathway. That's more similar to how drugs go through the approval process. And that's the PMA process, or the pre-market approval process. That actually does require safety testing. But unfortunately, really, it's less than 10% of devices that go through that pathway. So the vast majority of devices, the thousands of devices that are new devices that are pumped into the marketplace every year, go through the 510K mechanism, and that mechanism is based on a predicate presumption, meaning that a manufacturer could basically claim that you know, a device is substantially equivalent to a previous device, and that's basically sufficient for the FDA to give approval. Now, if the manufacturer decides that they want to, you know, include any further literature, etc., on the safety profile, they can, but it's not a very stringent process in terms of safety. So the goal of it, frankly, is to introduce medical devices as quickly as possible into the marketplace. And frankly, the effect of the 510K is that the population is being used as guinea pigs for these, you know, new devices that come into the marketplace. The trouble is, you know, that on the market side of things, the self-reporting that and surveillance that's required to have such a non-stringent approval process is also not in place. So it's really like a double whammy. So the device manufacturers are pumping out devices as rapidly as they can at the marketplace because that's what they do. And on the market side of it, physicians want to use increasingly innovative and novel technologies. But the reality is that no one's really watching what's happening, you know. No one's really looking at outcomes with any degree of fidelity. And the reporting mechanisms that are in place are not prosecuted and enforced strictly enough to ensure compliance by practitioners and hospitals. So what you have is essentially a giant crack, a safety crack, if you will, in the medical device regulatory space. And frankly, you know, what's completely astonishing is that this thing, this defect was pointed out to the United States Congress in 2011. I believe it was November 15th, 2011. And it was a completely striking and astonishing fact that that the senators who listened to this in the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee were some of the most liberal and progressive senators in the country, and you know, people like Al Franken who from the state of Minnesota, who you know, sided with the medical device industry because Medtronic is in Minnesota, right, and essentially shot down this critique of the medical device regulatory framework, which was generated by the Institute of Medicine. I mean, you know, the Institute of Medicine in the United States is probably one of the most scholarly bodies that is, funded stimulated by the federal government to make sure that deficits in our healthcare infrastructure and in research infrastructure are identified. And so, you know, the fact that the Institute of Medicine comes out with a 300-page report that says the 510K mechanism is posing a patient safety problem, and then senators like Al Franken and Bob Casey, who, you know, are proclaimed Robin Hoods in the United States Congress, you know, who are supposed to be fending for, folks who are in harm's way, these folks are the ones who were actually standing on the side of the medical device regulatory, on the side of the medical device industry, and essentially shot down the IOM report. So, you know, it's a very deep trouble, and it's very, very troubling because I think what's driving it is economics, not lives.
Oh, absolutely. And did you ever investigate, do you know anyone that investigated to see how much money these senators got from these device makers and contributions to their campaigns? Anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, Senator Franken, I think, you know, it's public information. Senator Franken, is very abundantly funded by the medical device industry, by Medtronic in particular, and you know, he's a well-known advocate for the interests of Medtronic, simply because Medtronic is such a large industry in the state of Minnesota. So and the same goes for Senator Elizabeth Warren up in Massachusetts, who, you know, Boston Scientific is up in Massachusetts, and you know, we found it completely astonishing that despite her initial statements of support for our morcellation campaign, for our anti-morcellation campaign, when we got down to the root cause of the problem, which is really the medical device regulatory framework, you know, Senator Warren went underground too, you know. And so really, it's been really an amazing journey because the folks who one would expect in the United States Congress would stand up to, you know, protect people in this setting have really stood down, and it's been a major disappointment, frankly.
Oh, yes, and I think I can tell you 10 years ago, when this was happening, when congressmen and senators and things were getting all this money from drug companies or device makers, you know, it wasn't so, you know, well, they did get as much, that's for sure, as they do now. But it was like they didn't willingly take it, you know, so willingly like they do now, and not so much. But even when they did, you know, they didn't absolutely stand by the drug maker or the device maker. But now it's so blatant that they get all this money and they don't even care. Like you said, you go to them, and this is something that, right, they should seriously be looking at, that's harming so many people, and they just stand back and don't do anything.
Well, you know,
so
I think it
jumps
just,
out the money that they get from these.
Well, the trouble also is that I'm not sure it's necessarily that they don't care. I think it's that the strength of the medical device lobby is not to be underestimated. And I think, you know, when you talk about professional lobbyists who belong to any industry, frankly, I mean, these folks do their homework, and, you know, they're pretty well fortified. And in fact, there's no shortage of people, you know, in industry who blow smoke and create, you know, what seems like a gray area from things that are pretty clear cut. So, for instance, you know, in the Morcellation fight, you know, it's pretty clear cut that if you have a tumor inside a woman's body and there's a chance that this should be cancerous, right, that this could be cancerous, that you shouldn't really mince this up. You should take universal precautions to protect people. Now, somehow, the industry advocates have turned this conversation into, you know, whether there's this tit for tat, whether it's like 1 in 300 or 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 2,000, as if it really matters, you know, what that number is. Frankly, right, you know, the reality is that this is an avoidable practice, and that the reality is that most surgical specialties actually view this as a mistake. And so somehow this has come into gynecology, this morcellation, and the gynecologists have accepted it as a standard of care. And now that we're pointing it out, instead of everyone sort of standing back and saying, yeah, you know what, this is just wrong, they're blowing a lot of smoke. They're turning into this numbers game, which is a complete, you know, red herring, frankly. And you know, when they do that, people like Senator Warren, people like Al Franken, probably stand back and, you know, they're listening to their well-dressed, well-fed, you know, well-paid lobbyists and who are telling them, look, it's more complicated than this. And they just listen to them because they're present, you know. And the reality is that when people get harmed, they're not present in the democratic process anymore, because people who are harmed, they go home, they go bankrupt, or they die, you know. And so their voice is not being heard by our Congress. Well, who's talking to our Congress are a group of well-dressed, well-paid, and well-fed lobbyists. And folks who have enough health to blow smoke, so so-called advocates.
Mm-hmm. And now that, you know, that procedure had become so common and everything, and there's great money being made off of it, so the gynecologists, you know, you're fighting against them too. They don't want to give up this procedure.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a whole, you know, for the past 20 years, a whole infrastructure has been built on it. You know, many gynecologists had trained on this practice, right. And so, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure devoted to it, and you know, it's very difficult to give up the revenue stream. I mean, you know, this is the hysterectomies and myomectomies are probably one of the top 2 or 3 procedures performed in the country. The numbers are pretty staggering. I mean, you know, somewhere around 60 to 70% of women in the United States by the age of 70 have either a hysterectomy or a myomectomy. So, you know, these are very high volume practices. And when you're talking about a procedure that for 20 years has become, you know, pretty much their standard, it's extremely difficult for them to give it up, you know, because there's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of money, a lot of training, and a lot of ego, frankly, wrapped up in it. So, you know, they had a very hard time. And in fact, the vast majority of them are really fighting against us on this.
Right. I know. And when I was talking about the players before bullying you, you know, I want to talk a little bit about that the article that got in the New England Journal of Medicine. Well, this is another thing that they do. The hospitals, gynecologists, device makers and everything, they use the media and they use medical journals and stuff to plant, you know, to plant articles and stories and everything, like to dissuade your campaign. And there was one in there that this I found so appalling, that by an employee of Brigham and Young Hospital writing an article. Brigham and Women's, yeah. Hospital in the New England Journal of Medicine when she worked there. And then she claimed that Amy had stage 4 cancer, making it sound like she had that when she went for her surgery, when we know that wasn't the case, and she gets away with doing this, and she's and where did she get that information to begin with? She didn't have consent.
Well,
for
yeah, so
record.
So we do suspect foul play in that, and you know we were very grateful to the cancer letter for really focusing on this issue and debunking it. So if you actually go to the cancer letter, you'll see that the past 2 issues. They really focused in on the New England Journal of Medicine paper by Dr. Lisa Rosenbaum, and they really debunked the whole thing. Now, you know, the trouble with that paper, aside from the fact that they engaged in some really poor journalism, I mean, they never really checked Amy's medical records. They never really did any fact-checking, you know, in writing this opinion piece. And, you know, and the New England Journal of Medicine, I have to tell you, is one of the most prestigious and powerful academic medical journals in the world. So, you know, a vast number of physicians in the United States, you know, read or refer to the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's not a small deal. So they published this opinion piece, and Dr. Rosenbaum essentially made two claims in this article. Number one was that the morcellation policymaking that the FDA engaged in was based on an N of one, meaning that it was Amy's case that stimulated a media frenzy that led to the FDA making a policy change. This is a complete misrepresentation because, you know, at the Brigham itself, there were at least three women, maybe four, who had been harmed by this practice. One of them died. Furthermore, the data demonstrates now that their incidence is somewhere between 1 in 350 to 1 in 500. Now, that's different from the 1 in 10,000, which these folks had been assuming before. And so this Dr. Rosenbaum is basically claiming that the incidence, that the policy change was a result of N of one policymaking. That's number one. Number two, Dr. Rosenbaum really is sort of portraying Amy and I as these availability entrepreneurs is what she calls it, meaning that we've taken advantage of this sort of awful situation to exploit the media, to create a media frenzy, a hype, if you will, you know, to convince the public that something is bad that's not bad. So she's creating this sort of, argument. She's creating this argument that this was all media hype. Now, you know, I can tell you that from the perspective of epidemiologists, you know, when you go from a 1 in 10,000 risk stratification to a 1 in 350 to 500 risk stratification for development of an advanced stage cancer, okay, this isn't hype.
Right.
Okay, this is a risk factor for advanced cancer, you know, that's man-made. That's something that we do, you know, that puts women at risk. So the concept that that Dr. Rosenbaum is trying to promote, that this is somehow hype, is really an egregious characterization. But the thing that I also find most concerning about the New England Journal of Medicine paper is that she makes the point that everything in medicine is a matter of a trade-off. And so, you know, in this case, the argument is that the trade-off is majority benefit. So if a minority subset of women are being harmed by an avoidable medical practice, you know, so long as the majority are benefiting, so long as it's convenient, so long as it preserves choice, and so long as it's economically beneficial, it's justified to put these women's lives at risk, you know? So, and unfortunately, I have to characterize it this way. A lot of people sort of frown on it when I characterize it this way. But I think that's a fundamentally fascist argument, you know. That is,
absolutely,
you know, using an argument that as long as the majority benefits, it's okay to sacrifice the lives and the rights and the dignity and the health of a minority subset of patients, you know, for the benefit of the majority. This is not the way we practice medicine, you know. This is utilitarianism at its extreme. That is turning into, what I can only characterize as fascist ideology within American medicine in the year 2016, and I don't think we should any of us should stand for it. It's completely corrupted.
Well, I'm glad people are hearing this from two doctors, you know, that to hear, you know, from people in the know and from people that weigh these risks. Everything, you know, that I think this is a plus to your campaign that you're both doctors, so you know how the system operates. And you both, with your medical ethics, don't believe in this kind of treatment. And thankfully, you know, that we have doctors like you. That, I mean, for them to have went on when they knew thousands of women were being killed for 20 years, for them to have went on when they knew the difference, that it was not 1 in 10,000. They knew back in 2006, wasn't there a doctor that complained to one of the medical device makers then?
There was a physician pathologist, actually, by the name of Dr. Robert Lamparter in a community hospital in Pennsylvania who came across this problem in his small community hospital, and he estimated in 2006, he estimated that the incidence at his small community hospital was 1 in 300.
Right.
And so he wrote Johnson & Johnson, and he reported this to them. they essentially blew him off, and they sort of made the problem go away, and Dr. Lamporter at the time, he decided, his hospital administration decided that, this is something that the gynecologist should take care of, and it's not really the pathologist's area of expertise. And so it was essentially, it sort of fell to the wayside, despite the fact that Dr. Lamporter had done the right thing. And so, it wasn't until December of 2013 when Dr. Lamporter got in touch with me and shared with me all his documents showing that in 2006 he had attempted to warn Johnson & Johnson. Now, that warning to the executives of Johnson & Johnson and Ethicon never made it back to the FDA. It never even Right. made it into their own system in terms of, at least I don't believe so. It'll hopefully come out in discovery, but it was never even vetted within Johnson & Johnson itself, I don't believe. It went to the wayside, and from 2006 until 2013, women continued to get harmed.
Right, until now, the patients and everything didn't know anything about this, so that's going on 10 years. Because of your campaign, it's just coming out now.
Well, our campaign started in 2013, and I think pretty much over the past 2 years, there's been a pretty sharp curtailment of the use of power morcellators across the country. But I have to say, Johnson & Johnson withdrew the product from the market, but, Carl Storz, which is another company, in fact, it's the company that made the device that harmed my wife, that company has adamantly dug in, and they have refused to take their device off the market, despite the fact that Johnson & Johnson, which was the largest manufacturer of the disease, of the device, did take the morcellator off the market. So there's a lot of sort of, greed and incapacity to really think in an ethical fashion that goes on in both medicine as well as in our corporate infrastructure. So, this really is an example of, unfortunately, of a pretty massive failure, and I think we can learn a lot of lessons from this in terms of fixing the system.
Well, I believe that, and big thanks to you and Amy. I mean, her battling cancer this whole time off and on, and staying in this campaign, I mean, people have a lot to be grateful to you two for. They really do.
Well,
because, again, being that you're doctors, but you're also, in the middle of this, for being a victim of this, and like I said, battling cancer off and on, so... to stay out here and to, get this word out to the public that surely should have known about it for ages, because like you said, hysterectomies are so common that
yep.
so many women have them.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah, it's,
and they
it's,
didn't
it's a
know
completely
this.
Agreed. It's a very unfortunate and egregious statement on the state of our professional societies and the state of many physicians where, a lot of docs have been aware of this. A lot of physicians, a lot of gynecologists have been aware of this, and no one has really made a loud enough stance to at least translate this into an informed consent setting where the women were informed. Women weren't even informed. I frankly don't think that this issue is a matter of informed consent. I mean, this is bad medicine, and bad medicine is never justified by informed consent. Even if you inform women of the risk of cancer upstaging, if you're that woman who has the cancer, so what if you were informed? Your cancer is still upstaged. So, the principle should be to take universal precautions to protect every woman from upstaging of her cancer. Now, the fact that, not even informed consent was happening until we came onto the scene is really an egregious statement on the state of mind that many physicians and medical organizations have in mind right now. I mean, and I think, frankly, it all comes down to dollars and cents and liability and revenue. If you're generating good revenue and if you're comfortable, and as long as it's a small enough subset of people getting harmed, it's going to be business as usual, And I think that is, frankly, it's fascism creeping into every facet of American society, including medicine. And I think we should all stand up and defend against it.
We have to. We are being hurt by so many of these things, these devices and procedures and drugs and things that are approved by the FDA, and if the FDA approves them, then everybody thinks it's fine. Everything's fine with this device or this drug, and that is not
true. Well, and frankly, Evelyn, it's not just in medicine that this kind of thing is happening. It's happening in the financial sector. It's happening in many different sectors of our economy. And, the reality is that as long as it's only a minority group of people who are getting hurt by whatever the transaction might be, you know, seems like the system is okay accepting it. And so I think that's you know, fundamentally what, you know, what we need to sort of accept is that the law of this land, the constitution of this country, was designed to protect every single individual from harm, you know. And I think, frankly, I mean, you know, a lot of people have sort of, you know, pointed to this argument of mine and said, you know, there we go, he's a libertarian. But no, it's not a libertarian argument. This is a constitutional argument. Every citizen of this country, everyone's life, everyone's dignity, everyone's health is protected under the laws of our land. So to have, you know, a federal agency like the FDA, or to have entire medical societies sort of accepting this concept that you know, as long as the majority are benefiting, we're okay to proceed with profitable industry or profitable business. I think this is an incorrect. This is frankly a violation of our ethos. So,
absolutely,
we got to defend against that.
In these regulatory agencies, and like you said, in all the different industries, they seem to be taken over by whatever industry that they're running, supposed to be regulating, and the rest of us are just left out here in the cold, not protected from any of the things they're supposed to be looking out for. And like you said, you know, when in a situation like this, yeah, most of these patients, you know, a lot of them probably don't have good insurance and things like this, and they get hurt and they go home and they go bankrupt and die.
And that's right. And I think that's fundamentally what it comes down to is if, you know, when you're hurt, when you're harmed by any sort of, you know, transaction, you know, you go home, you go bankrupt, or you're not lobbying the federal government. You know, you're going home and you're done. So you know, it really becomes incumbent on our federal government, and in fact, that's the purpose of our federal government, is to not only to stay out of the way of industry and the free market so that the free market could regulate itself, but also to protect individuals who are in harm's way. I mean, I think those are two basic principles that this country was founded on. You know, the notion that the federal government's role is not to interfere with the free market, but also at the same time to protect the lives and the rights and the dignity and the property of individual members of society. And I think that balancing act is somehow gone haywire, you know. Right now, what's happening is that the corporations have essentially commandeered our federal government. You know, so not only is the free market not really operational anymore, because the corporations are capable of, going into the generating legislation that protects their interests, both in court and out of court, but also the individuals whose lives are in harm's way, are in no way protected anymore. I mean, the case in point of it is the medical device industry. You know, I don't know if you knew, but within the medical device sector, there's a exemption clause, according to a Supreme Court judgment in Regal versus Medtronic.
I was just going to ask you to explain that.
This was a 2008 judgment on the part of the Supreme Court that basically protects medical devices that go through the PMA process from civil litigation. So if there's a medical device that's gone through the PMA process at the FDA and it harms someone, patients don't really have the right to take their cases to court. And this was legislation, that essentially went through the Supreme Court through a decision of Regal versus Medtronic. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so... They can't sue them. And isn't it a fact that even if they can prove that the medical device industry lied to the FDA when they were getting devices approved, you still can't sue them?
It's a pretty much of a carte blanche. I mean, you can't sue, and so I mean, it becomes up to the it's up to the individual judge whether or not to throw cases out of court. And now currently there's this controversy going on with this medical device called eSure, which is a sterilization device, again, in women's health. And, you know, fortunately, a federal judge has decided to hear these cases. These are PMA-approved devices that were previously exempt from civil litigation. You know, there are literally thousands of women harmed by the nickel-based device called eSure that goes into fallopian tubes. And these women were unable to sue. up until recently. So hopefully the court will listen and find in their favor.
And that's a federal judge, right?
That's a federal judge who basically has essentially gone against Regal. We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, because even if they win, then they can appeal, right? And then they can throw it out.
And then, hopefully, it can. I imagine it can eventually end up back in the Supreme Court. And if an argument is a strong enough argument is made, hopefully Regal versus Medtronic could be overturned. But the reality is, going back to this idea that corporations have somehow managed to secure not only their own interests vis-a-vis patients who are harmed, but they also have managed to skew the free market. So, when a patient can't sue when they get harmed, that means that the manufacturer is not going to get the input necessary to change their practices. I'll give you an example. Right. If you go to McDonald's and you buy a cup of coffee, and this cup of coffee is too hot, you go through the drive-thru, you pick up a cup of coffee, it spills on you, it burns you, causes a second-degree, third-degree burn. You turn around and you sue McDonald's will drop its temperature so that doesn't happen again, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's called the free market regulating itself, all right? And that's a very important mechanism in play, right? I mean, it's because it's blow for blow. If a product is bad, a consumer complains and things get fixed. But if the federal government comes in or the Supreme Court comes in and says, the consumer can't sue McDonald's, well, guess what? McDonald's has no impetus to change that temperature on their coffee, right? So their coffee will continue to spill on people, cause third-degree burns, and that's basically a distortion of the market, right? So what we have in the medical device regulatory space and in many other sectors, right, is not only has industry fending for its interests in terms of safety and security of the population, but it's also distorting the free market by sort of using the court system and to its advantage. So both of those, I think, ultimately need to be argued against from a constitutional framework, because I think both are essentially illegal.
Well, they sure were back when that case went to the Supreme Court, when Regal went to the Supreme Court. I covered all that back then, and it was terrible. And they were trying to get it on drugs, too, and then that didn't pass. But, I haven't covered that since. Has it passed that there's preemption for drugs, too, now?
I'm sorry?
For bad drugs. Do you know, I haven't paid attention to this. Has it passed so there's preemption for drugs, too, that drug companies can't be sued?
I think there are some preemption clauses. Unfortunately, Evelyn, I don't know the drug side of things as well, but, I do understand that there are some preemption clauses with regards to drugs as well, but I think that it's not as egregious as it is in the case of the PMA.
Well, and, of course, in the devices, too, it's more egregious because of the easy way that they get those drugs, those devices approved that you were talking about before. So, there isn't a stringent test that these devices are safe or a means of making sure that they are once they're on the market. So these patients that get harmed, they're let down by the watchdog and by the court system and by the device makers.
That's right. That's right.
They have every reason not to care if their devices are safe because they don't have anything to worry about.
That's right. They have nothing to worry about. Especially with respect to the PMA devices. And, the other layer of protection, frankly, is that, if a clinician uses a device and it's used in a so-called standard of care, the patient can't even take the doctor to court because, in order to prove a medical malpractice case, you need to demonstrate that there's been a breach of standard of care. So if the doctor is practicing a standard of care, most physicians end up saying, well, we were just practicing standard care. So the device, even the doctors are, for the most part, protected. But,
sure,
it's
and then
a very,
they,
very
they have what I refer to as front groups, pharma front groups that'll put out these standard of care guidelines. And so they can fall back on that. Oh.
Yep. These are the medical associations, like in the case of the Morcellator and in the case of eSure. It's the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And, these guys are all sort of, it's essentially like the set group of guardians that guard the castle, if you will, And it's very unfortunate because, Amy and I have been part of these associations for many years. And we have very many friends and colleagues who very, very dear colleagues and friends who are all members of such associations. But But, you know, the truth of it is that there's a certain degree of protectionism that's going on in the medical establishment that's really, frankly, unacceptable. And I think that at some level, the hope is that our, you know, court system and federal government at some point come in and recognize that you know, you can't be distorted. You can't be, you know, compromising patients' safety and at the same time taking away people's constitutional rights, frankly, to go to the market and distorting the free market, to go to court and therefore distorting the market. So.
Right. Well, I tell people all the time, the players that you're up against, man, I mean, you're up against them all. And I watch he's fighting this, and I'm just amazed that you keep on, you know, and that you've gotten so far, too. I mean, I've covered campaigns mostly against drugs, you know, and I see the big groups that go up against these drug companies, and boy, there just seems to be no way of stopping them. I mean, Senator Grassley was really into fighting against the drug companies with the psychological drugs and things, and he went all out, and he dug up, and I helped them dig up how these front groups were getting all their money from the drug makers and everything, and publishing these guidelines for prescribing drugs and things, and like you say, then it's a standard of care, and they were all funded by the drug companies and things. And once we brought this out, after that, it was nothing to them. All they did was post their annual reports then and showing how much they got from the drug companies. They didn't quit taking the drug company money; they just went right ahead with it. So it was like a 2-3 year investigation that revealed exactly what we thought, but it didn't do anything.
Right.
Didn't stop it.
Right. Well, I mean, unfortunately, Evelyn, I think it'll either require some degree of motivation on the part of a large enough body of congressmen and congresswomen, or it will require legislation through the court system. You know, the reality is that when it's really minority groups of people who are getting hurt, you know, it's very difficult to generate a, you know, if it was a vast number of people who were getting hurt, right, then it would be a no-brainer, because there would be a lot of constituents would be knocking on their congressmen's doors. It's when you're talking about minority subsets of people where, you know, you have one or two congressmen here or there sort of, you know, being champions for their constituents, you know, it just doesn't generate enough momentum in Congress, right? So really, I think the court system is going to be critical for fighting problems like this, because it's minority groups of people who are being harmed. You know, I mean, very fortunately, we live in a society where if something harms the majority, right, that thing is eliminated very quickly. I mean, that's sort of, you know, one of the amazing things about living in this day and age is that, you know, you very rarely come across things that are hurting a majority of people and they stay on the market for very long, you know. So it's really only products that are sort of hitting minority groups of people. And so then the question is, how do you protect those folks? So number one is, you either have to go back to the constitutional framework of protecting every single individual, or you have to let the court system, vet it out. And so, unfortunately, you know, what's happening is that both of those parameters are being skewed by industry lobby, and I think that's basically the target. The target is to get our Congress as well as our court system to listen to what's going on with these small groups of people who are getting harmed by big business interests.
Sure. And one of the things that I always tell people, you know, when I say all these players are bullying you, was when the device maker that made the device that harmed Amy, when you're out here telling the truth, you know, and out here getting newspaper reports and things that telling the truth about this device, what's happening, he threatened to sue you, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, I mean, you know, look, there's no shortage of misguided bullies in this
for
world, right?
For defaming his device, huh?
I mean, Amy was harmed by the Karl Storz device, and one of the executives at Karl Storz basically sent me a threatening letter saying that, you know, if we don't stop defaming them, they would sue us. And, you know, my response to that was and remains, please bring it on. I would be
right.
Delighted to, you know, demonstrate to the public and to the court system how misguided and disgusting this behavior is on the part of a potential, you know, a presumably reputable medical device company. But you know, the reality is the corporate America is made up of a variety of different people, and you know, some of them are more misguided than others. I mean, I think this gentleman is extremely arrogant, you know, and he felt justified in threatening us, taking a bet that, you know, we would sort of, you know, stick our head in the sand and go away. But the reality is that, you know, it was egregious behavior, and perhaps there are people out there who, when they get a letter from this from a big company, they basically stand down because they don't want to have the headache of dealing with, you know, a big company suing them for defamation. So, you know, our response, like I said, Evelyn, to this gentleman from Carl Stores was and remains, please bring it on. I'm looking forward to receiving that lawsuit still.
You know, and I had never seen something like this before, you know, in all my covering of all these drugs and devices. But when I saw that, that's what I thought of. How many people like me or the average person that don't have the money to fight a lawsuit against them, did back down and just not say anything more about it? That is terrible. And in return, it's set up so you can't sue them. But they can
sue the victim. You know, we could sue them, and we are suing them, Evelyn. You know, and then frankly, you know, I think the Carl Stores company stands to lose very big, because it's not just us suing them. It's at least five or six other individuals who have been really severely harmed. You know, there's a young lady up in New York who left a two-year-old behind, you know, and her belly was filled with bits of cancer morcellated by Carl Stores' morcellator. And you know, so that individual is suing. You know, there's another individual up in Boston who's suing. I mean, you know, these cases...
What legal theory are you suing under that you can get past that preemption?
Well, the issue with the morcellator is that it didn't go through PMA, so it went through 510K. So 510K devices, you can sue under product liability. So it's the example that when I was talking about market distortion, I was referring to the PMA devices.
Right. And, you know, before when you were mentioning about Johnson & Johnson pulling their device off the market, immediately I knew of everything that happened already, and it was like, well, yeah, because they know it's going to come out that they knew back in 2006, and they didn't report this to the FDA. So,
that's right.
You know, it sounded great, like, oh, great, Johnson & Johnson pulled their device off right away. Yeah, because they knew they had baggage that was going to come out that was going to prove that they knew. And this is
that's
what
right.
the FBI and the Government Accountability Office and stuff are looking into, right?
I hope so.
The
GAO and the FBI don't really share with us what exactly they're doing. But you know, one of the other things that's happening is that a lot of these plaintiff lawyers are settling on the power morcellator cases. And you know, frankly, I think that's equally egregious. You know, you have these plaintiff lawyers who are essentially don't even have to fire a single shot because the campaign against power morcellators has already been won, basically. So they're settling on behalf of these patients, and they're literally walking away with millions of dollars themselves, while they don't even create a public record. You know, each one of these cases is really an opportunity to create a public record so that nothing like this ever happens again, so that we find out exactly what went wrong and nothing like this happens again. Yet, you know, the plaintiff's lawyers are sitting around, you know, they're counting their beans and they're minimizing risk, frankly, to their own, you know, pocketbooks, and they're settling. So, you know, just recently, the Wall Street Journal published an article that, you know, somewhere around 50 or 60 of these cases have been settled by some law firm down in Texas. And, you know, I just find that completely astonishing that not even a single one of these cases they were able to get to court. But at the end of the day, I think everyone's greedy, you know. Everyone just wants to make easy money, you know, including the plaintiff's lawyers. So I think, you know, it's incumbent on people who have integrity and ethics and on the patients who've been harmed by this to really demand that their cases go to court, because there's a fundamental truth behind this. These are winnable cases, you know. And so, you know, I think it's the time will tell what happens here. But you know, we're taking one step at a time.
Right. And I've always felt that way, too, when they used to do it with drugs, you know, that they'd settle out of court and make everybody shut up, you know, and
That's
not
right.
talk about their injuries again or anything, you know, or say how much
That's
they
right.
settled for and everything. And how I got reporting on the drugs was I ran across somebody that slipped me information from one of these secret settlements against the drug company.
Yep.
And I wrote an article, leak, packs of information, leaks out or something like that. And And it was this case because, right, it was a person that was divorced from the person that had the lawsuit and everything, and somehow she knew, and I got this information, and I was glad to reveal it to show that, yes, then right. These people, it just dies down, and then the rest of the people that are on these drugs that still aren't getting warnings or anything this is going to happen, keep taking them. Don't know yep. What happened to all these people.
Yep. Every one of these settlements comes with a gag order, you know, and these gag yep. orders are essentially... each one of them is an opportunity for the public to be informed as to what went wrong, both at the level of, you know, marketing, at the level of regulation, and at the level of practice. And I think it's really a crime against public health when something like this comes up for any plaintiff's lawyer to accept a settlement. Now, I'm not saying, you know, you could settle at some point, right? If but at least create a public record for it, of it.
Right.
And I think that's something that hopefully at least a fraction of these cases will achieve.
Right. And and again, most of the time people, there are people that don't have much money or anything, so when they're offered an amount, it seems big to them, and then law firms talk them into it too, that there's not that many, and then usually if there's some that'll hold out, then they can't settle, so they get pressured from the other patients, and they go along with this, and it's so sad that it can be twisted like this. There ought to be a law against that, having settlements
yep.
that make
yep.
people be quiet about what happened to them, or what happened to their families,
or
whatever.
That's basically what it is. I mean, if you're settling, clearly there was a problem. If there wasn't a problem, right, the company wouldn't settle. If they're settling, that means that there was a problem, right? And so
oh, sure.
it's important, even if you settle, it's important to sort of at least have a document that's publicly available that says, look, this was the grievance and this was the response by the company. And they decided to drop it. And here's the, here's the, you don't want to publish a dollar amount. That's fine. But at the very least, here was the complaint and here was the response from the defendant. And they decided to settle, I mean, the fact that most of these come with a gag order is essentially suppression of information, especially in public health domains, that I think is again goes against the best interest of our country's public health.
Absolutely. I really do think, and I agree with you, they don't need to tell me how much they got or anything. I don't care how much they got paid. But...
Right.
I think there should be a law against keeping all that information secret about what the drug actually did or device, and so that other patients can learn this from these lawsuits at least.
Absolutely.
Nothing else.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a completely reasonable piece of legislation to suggest that, if a complaint is brought, that complaint should be public, and the response of the defendant should be public. And if the defendant and the plaintiff decide they want to settle, that's perfectly well their right. No one needs to know what amount they settled for, but, the complaint and the response to the complaint should be a matter of public record.
Right. Another thing I wanted you to touch on, that when these people get hurt and get stage 4 cancer from this morcellation, what kind of money do they end up having to pay for medical care and things after they get this?
Evelyn, it varies. Unfortunately, a large number of these women... with their cancer spread, we're not really lasting more than 2 years, during those 2 years, it's an enormous struggle to go through multiple operations, chemotherapies, all kinds of experimental therapies. So, it could be in the millions, and if you have good insurance,
right.
The insurance pays for it in most cases. Some folks decide to go out of the country and do experimental things that are way outside the box. So, it's not a small cost to a large number of these folks. And then you have people who don't have any means, and they just sort of languish and they die. It is probably in the millions. After each one of these complications.
Right. Do you mind me asking, how many times has cancer reoccurred with Amy now?
So since last December, Amy's had two major surgeries, and 4 rounds of radiation. So she's had 6 recurrences, and she currently still has tumors that we're tracking in her pelvis.
How is she feeling?
She's feeling very well, thankfully. You know, we're going through some experimental treatments, and she's in good spirits and doing very well. And you know, we are full blast ahead in terms of finding a cure, and we hope that in the near future we hope to be able to share what it is that we're doing and to hopefully bring a cure to a lot of people. So we're working on that actively.
That would be great. That would be great. And how are the kids doing?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Are they? That's wonderful. Yes. How old are your kids?
They range in age from 14 to 3.
3, yeah. The baby was how old when this happened?
Well, so the baby was about a year old when the operation happened, yeah. So the baby was born in September of 2012, and the operation happened in October of 2013, so he was a year old.
Right, right. Well, I'm glad to hear that the family's doing good. I'm so touched by that video of when you started your campaign against this. It's such a touching video. And did how many of you shaved your head?
Well, it was basically all of Amy's sisters. It was Amy's father. It was 2 of her friends, myself, and the brother-in-laws. So, it was basically the whole family.
Made me cry, I'm telling you. It was so touching. All of you, so caring and loving.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it was
wonderful to see a family like this.
It's been war, that's for sure. I mean, you know, we've been waging a pretty large-scale campaign, both on the procedure as well as on the cancer. So hopefully we'll have some positive results to share with everyone.
Right. Well, I'm not going to let this go until the song starts playing, so I want to talk to you a little bit about... can I get you back again in a few weeks or a month or something?
Sure. Yeah, we'd be happy to talk to you again.
How this is going?
Yeah, that would be great.
Because I really want to get this word out. I'm telling you, we've got to stop this. And I don't think if you drop this campaign right now, I think they'd go back to the way it was in no time.
I hope not. We have a lot of insurance companies and federal regulators who are on this issue now, and we have the GAO investigating. So I think... all that is going to hopefully keep the momentum going. And like I said, I mean, Mike Fitzpatrick, who's a congressman in Pennsylvania, has really been absolutely instrumental in this, and we hope that the Fitzpatrick office will continue fighting for us in Congress, and you know, I'm confident that he will.
Right. Okay, well, it was so good having you on, and I hope next time Amy can be on too, and give her my best, and the best to your family. Bless you all. So thanks a lot. We'll have you on in a month or so again, okay?
Thank you very much. Okay.
Yep, thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I hope you got some good information in this show. And I hope you'll go out there and campaign with Hooman and Amy, getting rid of this morcellation that's hurting people so badly. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye. Sitting in the middle trying to live my life.